Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other enlightening and entertaining programs that you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
About 70,000 years ago, there was an explosion. It was so huge, it closed off the sky and dropped the temperature into a freeze. And all over the world, ash fell for months. Hello, Robin Williams with In Conversation, this time with the man who's been tracking that astounding event. Surely one that changed human history all over the world. I'm with Professor Martin Williams, who's now at the University of Adelaide, but who's been looking for clues about what happened back then in India and in Africa. Martin, what's the story?
Quite by accident, in February 1980, I was in north central India with an honours student, and we'd logged 70 kilometres length of sections, cliff sections in the Son Valley, beautiful valley, Siddhartha country. And we spotted, or I spotted, something unusual halfway up this 30-metre cliff and turned to Keith and said, "Were this the Ethiopian highlands, I'd call that volcanic ash. Since no volcanic ash has ever been recorded in geologically recent times in India, we sample it every centimetre." And so we duly sampled it, climbed up, fingerprinted it. Every eruption, as you know, has its own individualistic signal, its own geochemical fingerprint. And it turned out to come from northern Sumatra 73,000 years ago. And Sumatra, or Toba, T-O-B-A, is now just a big lake, beautiful lake. And it ejected something like 3,000 cubic kilometres of rock equivalent in the form of ash. Compare that to Krakatoa, which is about 14 to 18. So we're talking about orders of magnitude difference. And Krakatoa, of course, killed 42,000 people. So what was the impact of this huge eruption, the biggest explosive eruption in at least the last 2 million years, probably a great deal longer? And once I'd put it on record, the lads and lasses of the Indian Geological Survey found it everywhere. It was all over India. And it was in the Bay of Bengal. It turned up in the Arabian Sea. It turned up 12 degrees south of the equator in the Indian Ocean. Then turned up in the East China Sea and in Greenland. And in the sulfur spike in Greenland associated with it, you have a 16 degree drop in temperature, which is quite dramatic.
That's gigantic, isn't
yes.
it? Yes.
And a decade and a half ago, a number of very cluey geneticists were looking at the mitochondrial DNA inherited through the female in human populations, and they speculated that somewhere between 100,000 and 50,000 years ago, the world population plummeted down to a few thousand males and females.
It's about 20,000, they said, roughly.
Wasn't it varies. Yes, some estimates say two, some say five, some say 10. So 20 is not a lot. And then recolonization out of Africa. Now, since that time, there's been a raging... No, academics don't rage. They're too polite for that. But there's been some fairly brutal debate. And one school says no impact whatsoever, because when you look at the artifacts in southern India, above and beneath the ash, they're the same. They're Middle Paleolithic, Middle Stone Age. Therefore, no impact. So I thought I'd take a different approach and did a transect across central India, about 500 kilometres. And we sampled the soils beneath the ash and above and the carbonate nodules in them. And we analysed the carbon isotopes, 12, 13. And so we had a fix on the type of vegetation that was growing at the time, what photosynthetic pathway it followed, so we could distinguish C3 from C4. And in essence, beneath the ash, right across central India, forest, and above the ash, mixed woodland and grassland. So that's a fairly indirect form of evidence. So then we, in a couple of marine cores, one just off North Sumatra, one in the Bay of Bengal, we looked in fine resolution at the pollen, and the pollen shows initially dramatic cooling, quite significant cooling, but it didn't persist. But the more interesting thing is that what you then see is prolonged drought lasting about 1,200, 1,500 years. And that would have been pretty tough on human societies of the day. They would have had to adapt. And some of our work in the Kenya Rift, the West Kenya Rift down near Maasai land, we're trying to document there the transition from Middle to Late Stone Age times. And putting it in modern terms, would you give your wife a frying pan for her birthday or would you give her a pearl necklace? Well, Middle Stone Age people opted for frying pans, Late Stone Age necklaces. And what you see in Late Stone Age times is much more care being taken in selection of the raw material to make the stone tools. You see the first evidence of objects of great beauty being made, which had no utilitarian value on the face of it. So we found, for example, and excavated a factory which was ostrich eggshell beads for making necklaces for the women. And one can speculate here, and it's purely speculative, that the impact of this catastrophic eruption and the effect it had both on the vegetation, both directly in terms of blasting the vegetation and indirectly in terms of the effects on climate, however long-lasting they may or may not have been, forced people to develop social networks, forced them to develop reciprocal relationships, and that assisted then in the movement back out of Africa across the deserts of Arabia and Pakistan, Afghanistan, and back into India and South Asia generally.
What a story. Now, some people have said that the reason that we're one race is that having been reduced to such a small bunch of people who, if you like, were the originals of Eves and Adams and led to all of us, means that we have less variety. Well, we've got no variety. We're one species. And it stems from that explosion. It stems from that reduction in the population. Is that controversial? You said there were some barnies about it.
A lot of people are yet to be convinced. In fact, more people are happy to accept the impacts of small volcanic eruptions. Pinatubo, for example, June 91. Global temperatures, as you know, dropped nearly 0.75 degrees Celsius over the next 12 months, which was equal to the net average global warming of the preceding 100 years. And that was a fairly minor eruption. And I've seen the impact at first hand of Mount St. Helens in the Cascades near Seattle. And that's pretty dramatic. But again, very small beer compared to Krakatoa. And Krakatoa is
a quart of tuba.
Well, quite, yes. So tuba was quite something.
Yes.
And I think no one research team will resolve this. We need a whole variety of approaches. But a number of geneticists now are looking very carefully at the so-called bottlenecks or founder populations in tigers, in gorillas, in macaque monkeys. And once again, you're finding this curious bottleneck around about this time.
Any idea what the Earth looked like then? It wasn't a snowball Earth, was it?
Oh, no, no, no.
Nothing as dramatic as that.
No, what makes it tricky, though, is that you're right on the cusp between a fairly long warm-wet interval, globally, moving towards the onset of the next glaciation. And that's why interpreting it has been tricky. And I think we've got the makings of a good story, and we need to do a great deal more.
Looking at the evidence in India, and then you hinted at Africa, where else would you look to get confirmation of this?
Oh, I'd look in caves. I'd look in caves, including Northern Australia. In fact, at the moment, I'm also looking, in a Stevenson sense, travelling, at some caves in the Flinders Ranges, where we may or may not pick up a signal geochemically. And then you can look at the isotopes, and you can identify temperature change and rainfall change. And caves in southern Africa are currently being looked at by some teams, and also in Indonesia generally. I'd love to get into some of the caves in Madagascar, which should have been close to the on the downwind side of this huge plume of ash.
Well, I wonder what the mountain looked like before, because in 1883, I think it was, when Krakatoa went up.
Yes.
It virtually obliterated not just the mountain, but the island. Any idea what Tuba looked like?
Oh, it would have been a vast volcano. It had erupted a couple of times previously, around about a million years ago. So there were three Toba ashes scattered, different parts of the world, primarily close to source. But again, they are geochemically distinct. They can't be confused if you look at the rare earth elements and trace elements in the geochemistry. So when we find Toba ash, we don't simply rely on chronology or, oh, that looks like it. I mean, You have to do it properly. This vast mountain was just an enormous lake that you can see on a kindergarten child's atlas of the world. You can see it from 30,000 feet up in the air. You know, it's big. And surrounded by welded tufts and quite high hills.
Is there anything else that could go on such a scale? Some people talk about Yellowstone. Is that possible?
Yes, I don't think that's an immediate likelihood. At least, let's hope not.
No.
But that certainly is one that's being monitored carefully. So, incidentally, is Toba. And all the predictions are Toba won't erupt on that scale for a very long time.
And what about Yellowstone? How way off might that be? Because it's been the subject of feature films.
I know. I think that we're talking millennia rather than centuries.
Okay, I shall relax. Now, take us to the Nile.
Please do.
Martin, the Nile.
Okay, well, apart from the fact that it's the longest river in the world and it carries a pathetically small sediment load down to the Mediterranean, you know, a mere 100 million tonnes, which is nothing. Now, most of that, about 96% of it, comes from the Ethiopian highlands. And the Blue Nile and the Apra have been going strong in one form or another for at least 20 million years. But most of the sediment's been dumped in the last 5 million. Since the flooding of the Great Canyon, which was cut when the sea level in the Mediterranean was low, 6 to 5 million years ago. But turning to more recent times, one of the things that's intrigued me and was how long has the present flow regime of the Nile been operating? And so we looked at the strontium isotopes in shells. I got probably the best freshwater mollusk shell collection for the Nile Basin anywhere in the world. And so we analysed those and turned out that you can fingerprint or you can identify very clearly catchments that are volcanic, catchments that are granite. And so you can identify the components from Uganda and the components from Ethiopia and compare that with the modern isotope values in the water today and in the shells or in the bones of Nile perch and so on in the vertebrae. So 15,000 years, we're quite confident present flow regime has been operating. But there have been intervals when there was no overflow from Uganda. And 4,200 years ago, for a period of about 2 or 3 decades, Lake Albert did not overflow. There was no overflow from Lake Victoria. So there was no flow into the great swamps of the southern Sudan, the biggest swamps in the world. And you pick this up 7,000 kilometers downstream in the clays in the Nile Delta. Again, analysing the strontium isotopes, this time in clay, and you see this sudden cessation of an input from the White Nile. And during drought years, the White Nile maintains the main Nile as a perennial river. And that's Old Kingdom times. And in the contemporary accounts, the whole social structure disintegrated. And in some accounts, people were eating each other to survive. One of the questions for the next few years, given that by 2020, or rather less, there'll be well over 300 million people dependent on the waters of the Nile for their survival, for their livelihood, what's the probability that we could have a drought of that magnitude and duration in the critical headwaters in Uganda, where the lakes are very sensitive to changes in rainfall and temperature? What we're currently trying to do, and it's going to keep me off the streets for the next 3 years, going back to Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopian highlands, is to look as carefully as we can and try and come up with a 30,000-year record of floods and droughts. We've got a 1,000-year flow record. We've got, for the last 10,000 years, the best flood record of any big river in the world. Now we now want to extend it a bit further, look at the different components, and then try and work out what's causing it. What are the forcing factors?
Where'd you get the evidence that people were being cannibalistic?
Accounts written very much later, which may or may not be circumstantial, but this 4,200-year event, you find right across into Mesopotamia and breakdown of the Akkadian civilization. So it pops up in a number of places. It was an abrupt climate change with catastrophic impact. And the physicians of the various pharaohs record the diseases of the day and the catastrophes of the day. And these were highly intelligent, very, very literate, very articulate individuals.
Yes, I was thinking it's very hard to get fossilised evidence of cannibalism.
No, of course not.
In the sense of cutting up and cooking and such like. It's just quite fascinating that you can actually have a programme lasting 3 years in front of you like that. How will you be spending your time? What exactly would you do in the field to collect some of this evidence?
We've already begun. We've been working in northern Sudan, where we've got three abandoned channels of the main Nile. And over on the western side, into the Sahara, into the desert, there are a couple of vast, now dry lakes. And one of these was actually fed by spillover from the Nile when it was in full flood, when it really was mega floods. And we've been looking at the diatoms in that. We've been looking at the freshwater mollusca. We've obtained optical dates, radiocarbon dates. And there are a whole series of archaeological sites associated with the abandoned channels over on the eastern bank. And this is near the Egyptian border. The British Museum Sudan Archaeological Survey and our team have documented well over 600 of these. And it's fascinating to see the way people hang in there till the bitter end, and then the channel is slowly choking with sediment, and then the river avulses, abandons course, and they have to move. And so you find the evidence there.
So what could be causing the drought like that on that scale?
A weakening of the monsoon system and the intertropical convergence zone, which brings the summer rain not extending as far north, and that's linked to sea surface temperatures in the southern Atlantic. And that in turn is affected by the ocean circulation in the main Atlantic and impacts of Antarctic sea ice. Every part of the world is linked and repercusses. So this interplay between ice, water, air, land, and, of course, vegetation.
So sea ice in Antarctica, in the south of the world, is affecting something in North Africa?
It can have that effect, yes.
How amazing,
and,
yes.
And we're trying to unravel that.
You say it'll take you 3 years.
Well, that's the sort of funding you get these days.
Oh, I see, okay.
Give me a lifetime of funding and I could do a great deal more.
It does really sound like a very active retirement, emeritus. You're not idle in the paddock, are you?
Don't want to be. No.
You don't really get fed up with being in the field, the kind of deprivations, the lack of comfort, and I presume it's fairly rugged out there, is it?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, I thrive on it.
Always have. I see.
Mm.
How much of the year do you spend doing that?
I used to spend up to 9 months of a year in the field when I was mapping soils along the Blue and the White Nile. Then I cut it down to a meagre 3. Now I'm even more focused because I have to persuade my colleagues to join me for longish intervals of time, and some of them have young families and are reluctant to go for more than a few weeks. I try and target it for anything from 1 to 2 months.
And in that area, you mentioned Sudan, it's not the sort of area which takes you into a war zone where it's even more uncomfortable.
Well, we're a bit limited extending upstream in the White Nile because once we get as far as Renk, one of the small towns, there are landmines scattered around, so that's an area to be presently avoided. We can get down to the Ethiopian border on the Blue Nile with no problem at all. We can extend up from Khartoum north into Egypt, and if for any reason there's some local difficulties, then we can head up into the Ethiopian highlands or into Uganda. So we're fairly flexible what we do and where we do it and when we do it, but we have to be prepared to move in at a moment's notice or modify our plans at a moment's notice. But I've been working in Sudan for years. I've worked in Ethiopia for years. I speak the rough gutter colloquial Sudanese Arabic. I have many colleagues and friends, and they regard me as an honorary Sudanese.
That's wonderful. No mishaps at all in all those years? That's amazing.
Oh, yes. I was bitten by a highly poisonous viper, Echis carinatus, locally known as Father of 10 Minutes in Arabic, and the viper died.
Oh, really? You killed the viper?
Well, I'm here to tell the tale.
Father of 10 Minutes, meaning that's how long you last usually?
Abu Ashra Degiga in Arabic, Father of 10 Minutes. That's roughly how long you expected to last once bitten.
What made you different and what made you kill it, do you think?
No. It died after it had bitten me, but my colleagues did that. They were a bit apprehensive. I took up collecting poisonous snakes after that for the Khartoum Zoo. I thought I'm going to be out here for 9 months at a time, and a lot of it I'll be more or less on my own or with a group of local Sudanese, and might as well habituate myself to what's going to go on.
And that shell collection that intrigues me, is that here in Adelaide?
Yes.
Back at the university?
Yes.
It's amazing because in America, there are a number of scientists who study rivers who've got collections of mollusks, which tell them the same sort of amazing stories about the history of the place.
But mine go back 15,000 and more years. It's based, you know, I've been collecting for a long time, and I've covered a lot of ground.
How many have you got, roughly?
I've never counted.
Hundreds?
Well, many boxes. Oh, many boxes. Yes. Yes, many hundreds, of course. And in the gaps in the collection, we contacted museums in Belgium, New York, British Museum, plugged some of the gaps.
It's an amazing life in the field, isn't it, really? Do you find it at all awkward doing it from South Australia?
Not really. No, I think I love South Australia. Love Australia generally.
I'm just thinking of distance. You can't nip over to the Nile every 5 minutes, whereas if you were based in Italy or somewhere.
It doesn't make much difference, really, because you simply catch a flight to Abu Dhabi, somewhere like that, and then pop over to Khartoum, and within half a day you can be in the field.
And, of course, you've got the wonderful terrain in South Australia.
I'm working here, too.
Right.
Oh, yes, I'm doing a lot of work in the Flinders Ranges.
Which is such an ancient site, isn't it?
Yeah, fascinating. We've been looking at ancient floods preserved in the ranges when extraordinary thing is that during a time that's been widely regarded as being cold, dry, windy and uniform for 5,000 odd years, we're picking up enormous variability and major evidence of extreme flood events. And the same story is emerging now from one or two other places. It's like reading a book where you've got half the pages missing, or more than half the pages missing, and you gradually, in some spot that you weren't expecting, pick up a missing page and slot it in. So it's enormous fun. One of the intriguing things that we found in the Nile was, you remember the bad old days of Emperor Nero? Well, you don't look that old, but he sent a couple of poor old centurions to find the sources of the Nile. And they returned. They made their way right into the swamps of the White Nile. And they returned, failed. And they went to see the emperor and said, "Noble emperor, we who are about to die confess that we were miserable failures. You know, our way was blocked by impenetrable swamps." And they described them very accurately. And they described the two granite hills, Jabal Abu Waga, that pop up from these swamps. The nearest swamps today are at least 300 kilometres further south, which means there's been a drying out and a retreat of the swamps. But the contemporary women living there at that time went down to the swamps, collected freshwater sponges, gently broke them up, and used the silica spicules of the sponge as reinforcing rods to make the most beautiful pottery that they traded over a distance of 1,000 kilometres. And, in fact, the sponge is Eunapius, Knight Ends, Penny and Rashek, if you want to know. But that technology, to the best of my knowledge, has only been recorded in two other parts of the world, once when the French arrived in Louisiana, and one group of Amazonian Indians in Brazil. Quite independent discoveries. And it lasted for about 1,000 years, and after that they gave it away.
Professor Martin Williams, I could talk to him all night. You can understand then why someone would want to study geology with forensic adventures all over the world, as you heard, searching for clues about momentous events in human history. He's Foundation Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Adelaide. Well, next week at this time, a different kind of conversation. Jonica Newby from Catalyst meets Caroline Lightwing, whose son Daniel won the silver medal at the International Maths Olympiad. And who has Asperger's syndrome? What's it like trying to bring up and deal with a brilliant but sometimes wayward boy like that? Next week on In Conversation. I'm Robin Williams. Production today by Nikki Phillips and Charlie McCune. Keep well.
G'day, Paul Barclay here from Australia Talks. Uranium mining is growing in South Australia with the expansion of the Beverley mine. Not so in WA. Here, possible legislation banning uranium mining was a key issue in the state election. Listen now or download as an MP3 podcast from the Radio National website. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Australia Talks.